things is for Mary's benefit. Between this week and last week, we actually we have a friend who is visiting Dharamsala and spending a little time with our teacher there. His name is Denmalocha Rinpoche. And
that's your teacher's name.
Yeah. Yeah, not the friend's name. Her name is Sandra. And she finally, after a whole series of adventures, wrote to us. And, yeah, that's fun. Up to a point.
Layering. It's all about layering.
And obviously this is going to get edited. Maybe not. Anyway. So she is speaking with Rinpoche, and so he sent his blessings to this event that's happening. Yes. Yeah. I mean, this event. I mean, this biweekly event, or whatever it is, which includes this evening. So that made me think about something to talk about this evening, which is, on the one hand, what is the role of the teacher? And on the other hand, what is the goal of the practice? As being related to each other. So, unless you want me to do something else, that's what I thought about. Sounds good?
That sounds good.
That sounds good. Okay. That's a tall order. Anyway, so, let's see if I can... It's easier to do this when there's a whole group of people.
Is it?
Yeah, actually. But let's see if I can do it.
You're putting them all out there and they're going to all be online.
Well, I know actors and television personalities and whatnot manage to do that. And I don't know how it is. You know, they just sort of imagine this large audience and they talk to them. I can't. Just about all the schools of Indian thought, including Buddhism, but more than Buddhism, have a view that people have coarser dimensions of themselves and subtler dimensions of themselves, or outer and inner. That's usually the way it works, that the inner is somehow subtle and the outer is somehow coarse. For example, thought is subtler than matter, and awareness is subtler than thought. Thought is coarser than awareness. And awareness is coarser than sheer existence. Sheer existence is subtler than awareness. So in that sense, the theories, all the Indian theories about the nature of the person, is that a person is a little bit like an onion in that respect, that they have all these layers, and that most people kind of live on the outside and are focused more toward material things. And because of that, even if they kind of turn their attention inward, they don't tend to see the subtlest things because they just sort of see the next level of innerness, or the next level of subtleness, but there are many layers deeper within. And again, most of the Indian schools of thought take the view that the deepest, or the subtlest, or the most central, or the most inner, is the most essential. And that the outer is the most transitory. So bodies are more transitory than minds. Minds more transitory than being. That's pretty much the way it works. So the goal of Buddhist practice is to somehow get to that subtlest place, that most inward place. And that's sometimes called Buddhahood, or Buddha nature. So unlike I think I've said this before, unlike Western religions where there's God out there someplace and one has some kind of relationship to God, either maybe affectionate or fearful or honorific or all these kinds of things, but mostly God is just out there someplace and we're over here. And then when we die, we get closer to God somehow because we don't have a body. So in that sense, there's some similarity. But the Buddhist view is that the fundamental element in reality, the fundamental element of a person, are the same thing. And that's their innermost self, their innermost quality. And that is their Buddha nature. So a Buddha is somebody who is fully there versus the rest of us who have that capacity within us, but we tend to live on the surface instead of living at depth. And then the whole thing in Buddhist practice is how to get from the surface to the depth. Now, Indian thought generally is not consistent in its view on this issue, that some schools of thought think that you need to just sort of abandon the surface or course and just as much as possible get to the center, because there are various problems with the surface, like we die, we suffer, these kinds of things. The Buddhist view is quite different in that it's more like, how do we live on all these levels at the same time? Not how do you stop living on one so you can get to the other, but how do you live on all of them at the same time? So how can you be, essentially, how can you be a husband and a Buddha at the same time? Or how can you be a wife and a Buddha at the same time? Which is... I've actually never seen it sort of phrased that way, but that really is what they're talking about. So, what is a teacher? So there are different kinds of teachers who are different because they're either more or less connected with their essential nature, with their Buddha nature. So the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, is somebody who is fully there. So he's the most there. In that sense, he's the ultimate teacher, the best teacher. Unfortunately, he doesn't have a body, so he can't go down the street and knock on the door and say, "Hey, Mr. Shakyamuni, I need some help here. What am I supposed to be doing?" But then there are other people who have come either more or less close to that central quality. And then that sort of characterizes what kind of a teacher they are. So somebody like the Dalai Lama is somebody who's really very close. Somebody like our own teacher is somebody who's very close. Somebody like me is someone who's done a lot of thinking about things but isn't very close. But I'm down the street, so I'm the best you got. But that's actually, you know, I mean, that's not unusual in Buddhist history, that everybody is pretty much viewed as being in this thing together and needs to be helpful to each other. So folks with a sort of a limited understanding offer what their understanding is, which may be very intellectual, like mine is. Folks with a deeper understanding have something deeper to offer. Now, one of the things that that our teacher said, Moja Rinpoche said, was that he would give his blessings to what we were doing. He'd think about us, he'd pray for what we were doing, and we would have his blessings. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's the way it was translated for us. So that could sound like really abstract, like, okay, you know, I'll give you good thoughts, or I'll hope for the best for you, or I pray for you, or something like that, like we might say. But actually, it's very concrete. It's actually, in fact, tangible, which is, thinking about that is what sort of got me going in regards to what we're talk about this evening, including to this audience out in Cyberland, like Mary and whomever. The reason I say it's tangible is, along with this idea that we have more external or superficial aspects of ourselves that are maybe coarser or more directed to the outer, you know, looking at the world, in touch with the physical world. Along with this idea that we're kind of layered in this way, there's an idea that we're made up, or that these layers are made up of energy and awareness in some relationship to each other. Kind of like in Freudian thought, Freud talked about psychic energy, he talked about libido. I don't know any really great metaphors for this. I don't know, maybe it's something that just seems completely common sense, that we have an energetic part of ourself, that our awareness is energetic in some character. I don't know if that seems common. Does that seem common sense?
It does to me. It always has to me. But I have always felt like in our society and country that it's not very accepted.
Really? Yeah.
And of course, I was trained as a scientist, which is like, you know, the school of thought is kind of like, prove it to me.
Right.
And if I can't prove it, it doesn't exist. Although physics is maybe the, and which I'm less of it, it's kind of the realm where they're most sort of out there, where they're going like, well, sometimes light behaves like a wave, like a particle, and we're kind of like, we're like blind people feeling the elephants, and we, you know.
Yeah.
But for biological science, chemistry, that type of stuff, it's pretty, you're supposed to be a skeptic, sort of, and then you're supposed to go through rigorous procedures to prove things. But I'm saying I've always felt certain things that are very much in line with something else. And I know I was brought up Catholic, where there's sort of, I'm finally starting to put that in perspective. I think it's kind of like, I mean, like you're saying, God's over here, we're down here, oh God, please, whatever. And it never felt, never fit.
Yeah.
The shoe never fit very well. It pinched in tender places. And so the idea of whatever you want to call it, this energy that's flowing through us, through all of us, and you sort of, I mean, like you're saying, the various layers, and you're accessing various intensities of that, I guess, if you understand it.
Yeah, then. I hadn't thought about that word, intensity. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, too, because the subtler levels are more intense than the coarse. I mean, that's been your experience, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm pretty new at it. I mean, I've been trying to figure out pursuing this for maybe a year, and I feel like I'm not that far into it. I feel like I'm probably out here, sort of on the outer shells. Actually, here's an analogy. You know, like with an atom.
Yeah.
In chemistry.
Yeah.
A lot of times, I've never thought about this, but there's they call them orbitals? There's like shells of the energy around the nucleus is in the center, and then the electrons are in various sort of energy envelopes around the nucleus.
Right. So are the outer less energetic than the inner? I don't know if that's the case, is it?
Again, I'm reaching way back, but there's an attraction, like the electrons are considered to be negatively charged, and the nucleus is considered to be positively charged.
I remember that.
There's protons that are positively charged in the nucleus, and then the electrons are negatively charged. So the outer orbitals, they're called, have a bigger area that we kind of use when we get closer in there. I'm sure I'm not competent to describe the energy involved, but these ones are a little looser and they're more. So yeah, I think the attraction is more intense closer in.
Okay. There's this interesting metaphor that the Tibetans have that when I ran into it years ago in regards to the energy and its relationship to awareness that struck me as really interesting. I mean, I asked a former teacher who died in 1991, I think it was, about the relationship between this kind of energetic quality that we feel like of our existence, seems to have more or less vitality or energy to it, and awareness, because it always seemed to me that when there was more intense energy, that awareness was sharper, or that when I got more into a sort of subtler inner place more, that the awareness was sharper, but the energy was also more intense too. So I was asking about that, and I said, so are they the same thing, or how are they related to each other? You know, energy and awareness the same thing or different? I mean, what is awareness was really the question I was asking, and what is consciousness? And I'm asking him this question because basically the Buddhist view is that Buddha nature is total consciousness. It's just sheer consciousness. It's the it's the consciousness principle, if you will, that pervades everything. So that, I mean, from that point of view, if I'm sitting here looking at you, you know, it's like the quality of me that has the ability to look at you and know you, and be aware of what's happening, is in its fundamental character. This is hard to talk about, but its fundamental character, it's Buddhahood. It's that essential something that that Buddhist practice aims for, that I think a lot of us walk around yearning for in some sort of way. That sort of sense of completion or at-homeness or what's the point of things-ness. I mean, the answer to that question, what's the point of things-ness? So I was asking about this. And the thing about the Tibetan Buddhist tradition is that it's very multidimensional. It's full of different points of view, sometimes which are seen as developmental, sometimes just like, well, we have a disagreement here, but we don't have any specific authority that we go to. There's no like Pope, Church, Cardinals that say, this is the truth, that stuff we don't buy, that's no good, you can't believe that, this is what you're going to believe. So Buddhists end up having a lot of disagreements about really important things, and sometimes have different points of view, which somehow coexist. And so I was asking my teacher about, well, so is consciousness and energy, are they the same thing, or are they two different things? Because they seem to have this relationship to each other. He said, yeah, well, there are different points of view on this one. I thought, well, that wasn't the answer I wanted. Just give me the answer, right? I'm like my own students who are always driving me crazy. Just give me the answer. I just give them more questions. So he said so many different points of view on this. He said energy and awareness always seem to show up together, have a relationship to each other, but are they two sides of the same coin in different points of view? Some Buddhist theologians say yes, some meditators say yes, and others say no. That all we know is that they have a relationship to each other, but we don't know what it is. He said, but there is this metaphor for their relationship, which is like a horse and a rider. He said that energy is like the rider and awareness or consciousness. Excuse me, energy is like the horse, and consciousness or awareness is like the rider on the horse, which is to say that awareness will direct where energy will go, like the rider will direct the horse, but the energy will carry the awareness around. So there's this metaphor. And that really stuck with me because I thought, well, that really speaks to something, that where you put your attention is where your energy goes, or where your energy goes is what you pay attention to. You know? So if if your energy is running after something like success or whatever, then that's what you're paying attention to. Maybe that's not a good example, but I think you get my point anyway. So one of the things about this metaphor is that what does that mean then when a lama says, I'm blessing what you're doing? So it doesn't just mean something abstract, and that was what I wanted to kind of get at this, and that's what I was thinking about. But it doesn't mean something abstract. It doesn't just mean like, well, I wish you the best, you know, and I hope everything works out or doesn't, whatever the case may be, you know, but good luck and like that. But it's more like if he's actually thinking about us, he has his attention on us. I mean, even if it's kind of abstract, I mean, he knows what Kay looks like, he knows what I look like, he doesn't know what this house looks like, so he doesn't know what my grand looks like, or this group. Yeah, he doesn't really know what the group looks like. But if he's thinking about us, that means his energy is engaged with us in some way. So it's actually tangibly here, because if his attention is tangibly here, then his energy is tangibly here. That makes sense. So if he says, so I'm giving you my blessing, it means he's actually bringing his energy to this situation. But then if he's bringing his energy to this situation, what's the awareness that's coming with it? Because on the one hand, he's thinking about Kay or thinking about David and thinking about this group of people that's in relationship to us. But what does it mean then if he puts his thought on us? It means in a tangible sense his energy comes here. But if his energy comes here, something else comes here along with that, because he's not just like you and I. I mean, he's farther along toward this Buddha nature. So something else comes and shows up. So we have that kind of experience when we go to spend time with the Dalai Lama. I mean, one reason for going, theoretically, is to learn something. You know, there's been some text that's being taught or something like that. But I very rarely go to the teachings specifically because I want to learn something. I mean, I often do. I mean, I might choose to go to one place that he's teaching rather than another because there's this thing I want to know about rather than that thing. But mostly I just want to get in his energy field because he's closer to that source, so the energy that is there with him, which is his energy, is closer to that source. So it's actually, you know, for ordinary people like us, it's actually very hard to find that energy. It's very hard. I mean, even if we have, even if we feel a lot of different kinds of things happening within ourselves, it's hard to identify which color in the rainbow to pay particular attention to, if that makes sense. because there's so much going on, it's kind of hard to say, I want to spend a lot of time with this thing over here, because that's going to take me to a certain place, rather than this thing over here, which might take me someplace I don't really want to go, or no place at all in particular, really. So the thing about being around somebody like that is you feel that kind of energetic blessing, whatever, that's there, and then you can tune into it. You can tune into it then, you can tune into it later to help you kind of get back to being focused on that place within yourself, which is otherwise hard to find. And it's, I don't think I'm describing this very well, but it's tangible. It's not intangible. It's not just totally abstract. It's something you can almost feel. It's almost palpable. Like maybe when you feel the excitement when you're skiing, there's a certain something you feel that, I mean, maybe it's adrenaline and so on and so forth, but there's something there. There's something that you can almost lay your hands on. Well, here I'm talking about the same thing. There's something that you can almost lay your hands on. But again, this this energy, whether it's really subtle and closer to the source or not, this energy is associated with awareness. I mean, these things are always coming together. So, there's specific thoughts or specific images that are associated with awareness. I mean, it's not just like merely awareness. I mean, it's not just some sort of like sea of consciousness. I don't even know how to describe this. There's an awareness of something. There's a consciousness of something that's associated with this energy. There's always a consciousness of something. I mean, it's the nature of consciousness or awareness to be conscious of something. So, you know, what is that? Well, people like the Dalai Lama are aware of what's going on within themselves. I mean, they're having thoughts, they have images about who they are, what they are, as beings. So, when you're around that kind of energy, sometimes those images appear. I mean, you run into them. This is starting to sound really chaotic and strange, but what I'm trying to get at, no? Okay.
Not yet.
Not to you? No. Okay.
It's like you're going somewhere.
Yeah, because what I'm trying to get at is that just as we have self-consciousness, in which we have an image of ourselves, like you see yourself, you see Brian. When you think about yourself, you see Brian in a certain way. When I think about myself, I see David in a certain way. So when the Dalai Lama thinks about himself, he sees himself in a certain way too. How does he see himself? Well, he sees himself as being Buddha-like because he understands himself in that way because of his own development, as associated with certain specific images. So this is getting at this kind of practice. I'm trying to get at this practice with images that we do. Like, what is the power of meditating on an image of the Buddha? Okay. So the power of meditating on an image of the Buddha, or meditating on an image of the Dalai Lama, for example, or in our case of our own teacher, seeing him is a way of tuning into that quality, that energetic nature of that being, making contact with it. Does that make any sense? Okay. So, like in my own practice, so Lhotse Rinpoche was saying, just as you think about me with devotion and offer your concern and your prayers and whatnot, so I think about you in the same way. What he's saying is that between us there's this flow of energy, of spirit, of blessing, whatever you want to call it. And it's based upon my remembering him and what he looks like and who he is and the quality of his being from being around him. And he does the same thing with me. And so between the two of us, something happens, even at a distance. You know, I mean, it's stronger if he's here, but it's still there, even though he's on the other side of the planet right now. I mean, I can still sort of feel that. I can still sort of feel him. Same with the Dalai Lama. And the same with his teachers. I mean, that was his experience and his own teachers. And in the same way, the same with Shakyamuni Buddha. So this kind of thing of like remembering the Buddha, remembering that image, is a way of attuning to both his energy and awareness of that actual person through the image of him. But in another sense, he's also our deepest self. I mean, he achieved what we're all trying to reach. So, in some complicated way, remembering him is remembering ourselves, if that makes sense. Because remembering the Buddha is remembering, because the Buddha achieved what we're trying to achieve, right? Remembering him is a way of remembering that part of ourself which we're trying to achieve but don't quite know what it looks like or how to get at it. Right, so it sort of takes a tangible form in that way, tangible kind of energy in that way. And it is tangible. It is tangible because of the way in which energy and awareness come together. So when you have your awareness on that image, on that person, you're actually attuned to the energy of that person. So that this kind of meditation on Shakyamuni, this meditation on this image, is not just abstract. It's actually, it has this tangible, potentially, this tangible quality that comes out of it. That was so hard to talk about. I don't know why, you know? I felt like I was bumbling around all over the place.
Years, you know, because David did all this energy work in yoga training before he got into Buddhism, and for years and years he's been talking about energy, and I would always go, what are you talking about? I don't quite understand it in relationship to this, to my body and my meditation and all that kind of stuff. I think I'm getting a little bit more of it from becoming a little bit more body aware. Like, you're probably very body aware because of this. You have to be. Be a seer, I would say. You have to be very body conscious. Do not break your arms and legs or flying down the hill, right?
I've always, and skiing is my best example of it because that's what my passion is, and that's where I put all my statements, my attention in terms of physical activities. You know, there are times in learning to ski where I put my attention in an analytical way, and like it worked best for me to just totally isolate. Like, I'm gonna really focus on where the fall line is, like the steepest part of the slope, and that's where the energy is. I mean, that's gravity, that's pulling mm-hmm. me down, and there's a tendency to be afraid of that. Mm-hmm. Because like you're turning, you're coming across the slope. If you're trying to go this way, and here's the fall line, it's going to take you this way. Mm-hmm. So at one point in time, I said, okay, I'm going down the fall line. And my skis go like this, but they're always coming into the fall line. That's where the energy is. So like when you're on the learning curve, you're just, for me, I can only do one thing at a time, so I focus on that, or I focus on where I'm putting my feet holes, or where my feet are, whatever. When I'm just doing it, I'm not thinking. It's best if I'm not thinking at all. That's when I have my best sleepiness, is when I'm just doing it. And it's flowing. I mean, I am thinking, there's a million things going on. If you're skiing fast, you know, stuff's going by real fast, and it's like the snow is changing, and you've got to look at the topography, and you got to pick where you're going to turn. And you're instantly making all these decisions, but you're also just doing it at a sub. I was going to say at a subconscious level. I mean, you're not thinking about it; you're just doing it. And like, you know, the things that I in my life when I think about the things that I'm doing, then I'm just doing it. And that's for me what I feel like I'm tapped into. That energy, that, I don't even know what to call it.
The zone, the flow, the flow, the zone, something like that. Doesn't that? That's language people have used. But so, but you're the one.
Well, I think that I'm getting closer to understanding energy by getting more body awareness, because it does seem to have association with the coarse body as well as the, you know, some of that, you know, there's something there that if you're not, you know, if you're only aware from here up, you know, or here up or whatever, that you just, that you're not really, it's harder to feel the earth or incorporate that whole energy flow. You think that's true?
Well, yeah. Sure, yeah. I mean, because the subtler, the quality of ourselves is subtler than the superficial place we live, it's distributed throughout our entire body, mind. I mean, it's like, it's every place within us, and even outside of our skin. You know, it's not restricted, it's not just from your neck up, or, you know, it's like... I don't know exactly how to express this. Yeah, when the Chinese talk about qi, that's what they're talking about, and they talk about it flowing through the whole body. But you can actually, excuse me, to get at the question that you've asked me for years, you can actually feel it like a stream in your own body, move through your body. I mean, I don't know how to explain what it is beyond this that you're feeling, but you can actually feel something within yourself moving. That's it. I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, it's kind of like when you've felt it, you know what it is. And if you haven't felt it, you don't, and you can't describe it to somebody that hasn't. It'd be like somebody that's never seen orange. How do you describe orange to a person that's never seen orange? I mean, I don't know what you say. It's kind of like red. And, I mean, what is it? You know, I don't. Words really fail. But so words fail. But you know, we've all been psychedelicized, so I think we know what we're talking about. I think. Poor Kay, everybody thought she was a stoner when they looked at her art. And it's like, never, no, not her thing at all.
But then I was just thinking about your art, because when you're doing your art and you're in the zone, I'm guessing you're kind of like what I was describing when I'm in the zone when I'm skiing. Is that sort of true?
Sort of true, but I, for years... it wasn't body awareness that was connected with that. And because of that, I would do harm to my body. Like a wind stick break. And so it was some way that even though I was in the zone, or it felt like that, that it was just like this energy of creativity coming through, there was a part of me that was not connected to that. And because of that, it was actually doing harm to the coarser part of my body. Because I wouldn't take breaks, I wouldn't move. And get up, you know, and eat, you know, and drink water, you know. Just, yeah. So it's kind of, yeah, it is interesting that way. On the other hand, when I garden or something like that, yeah, that one involves body, and I can get into that then very easily, gardening. And then the sweat, that course, then I work for 10 hours off the garden without
you trash your body another way.
Right? Yeah, it's like, so, yeah. So it's hard to find that. But
today, when I was climbing up and down the skis, and the climbing skins, they're like, they strap on the bottom of your ski. And the original ones, the Scandinavian guys were made of seal skin. So it's like a one-way map on it. So you go up the hill and it kind of grips. So you're kind of like a fly on the wall, you know? It's really cool. So Deepak Chopra has this thing, the law of least effort. And it's like, you know, it's like what, I've never been a good swimmer, but what my swimming teachers attempted to teach me was how to move through the water with the least amount of resistance and therefore expending the least amount of effort in the swimming. And, you know, so it's the same kind of thing. It's like I'm climbing up the mountain, and if my balance is in the right place with my skis and I'm moving my skis in the right way and using less effort, getting the same distance with less effort. And your breathing's part of that. And you can, and it's very, it can be very meditative. You can get in the right place. You're just, it's repetitious, and you're breathing, and you're out in nature, and if you put your attention in the right places, it's extremely both meditative and, as I understand the purpose of meditation, it's kind of like to get to that place between your thoughts and to experience that and to go in, to delve into that area. And I feel, like you say, it's tangible. I feel myself going there, and sure the thoughts come in and this and that, but it's just very much like what we've done here, but in a different setting and a different, but yeah, I'm very much aware of the flow of energy because I'm expending energy, body energy, as well as my, as well as trying to direct my attention of my mental energy in a way so I'm not tiring my brain out too. Because you can go, I mean, we've all done this. You can be up there climbing a mountain or whatever, and just all you. Thinking about your job or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You just can't leave
it behind. Yeah. Maybe it goes back to the relaxation thing, too, because it, being relaxed and alert, you know, in meditation. That's one of the things I had to relearn. And it sounds like that's kind of what you're talking about, too. Even going up the mountain, even though you're expending energy and it takes, you know, that nevertheless that you're feeling relaxed about it. Mm. And that's maybe the effort. Was part of it, so the least effort part of it, is it somehow being relaxed at the same time being very focused and alert, which is also, I think, one of the first things that takes you there, maybe, in semi meditation as well, and helps you get to that. That's what I found being important.
In this zone, there's a certain quality of presence, of beingness, isn't there? Like, it's not unconscious, you're like very there. And there's a sense of something that can, I think, only be described as presence. And I was just thinking about that because the Tibetans, when they talk about His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I mean, for one thing, His Holiness, that's a Western honorific. There's no Tibetan for His Holiness. The other thing is that Dalai Lama is not a Tibetan word either. It's Mongolian. The way the Tibetans refer to him is as the presence.
The presence.
Yeah. Kundun. That was the name of the movie?
Yeah.
The presence. Huh. I mean, he is totally present. He is the presence. His presence is full. So this deep energy is also about presence, and you know, what does that mean? I mean, it's a quality of existing or being which is fuller than the way most of us exist or be. So, I don't know. I mean, I've experienced that when I'm around him. I mean, like you know, sitting across him, like I'm sitting across from you, Brian. It's kind of like there's this person that's there who's just not like any other person because of his... Well, actually, I've met several people who are kind of like that. They're all different, but they all have that kind of weightiness of their being. Maybe the way to phrase it. Weightiness of their being. That's because they're in that center place and they're fully present. They're kind of like in the zone of beingness, maybe. That's the thing to say.
Yeah, and you're saying you can feel that.
You definitely.
Presence, and it's very authentically real.
Yeah.
And what you're saying with your teacher, like blessing, present right now, that's sort of an expression of that same sort of exchange of energy.
Right, and he's lending his presence to the event.
Yeah.
He's bringing his presence to the event. He's lending his presence to the event. Although, obviously, he wasn't giving me his clarity this evening. I thought maybe he would, but... Well, maybe he did. Could have been a bigger botch.
No, I understand very well what you're saying, so don't be hard on yourself.
Okay, I was striving for quality of clarity and eloquence that I couldn't get at because the subject matter doesn't lend itself to exactly a logical exposition. And trying to find words for what I'm referencing is just incredibly difficult.
Well, what about mind-to-mind transmission? That kind of what we were talking about too. In the Zen tradition and in the Zen tradition,
that's exactly what we're talking about.
Take initiation. That basically, you know, like a ritual, a lot of the things that go on during initiation, they're setting the stage or the ground for what they call mind-to-mind transmission.
Yeah.
I mean, you can say something.
Yeah. Well, what?
Because I find that really fascinating.
Well, that's what Kay's referring to here is that, and she's pulling something from her own experience at Zen Center, but it's in the Zen tradition from way back, 7th century China, this kind of thing. The stories about Zen in China are that the first Buddhist patriarch is called Bodhidharma. Came to China from India, which is possible. I mean, at that time it happened. Probably would have taken a ship around Southeast Asia if he was Indian. And then he had a student, and then that student had a student. So each of these were the main student. So each of these were the patriarchs or the ancestors, as they now like to say a non-gender term. When they refer to the relationship between these teachers, like the teacher and the student, they say that what happened was there was in English it's called direct mind-to-mind transmission between the teacher and the student. That something went from the mind of one to the mind of the other, and that something, that connection, was the essential thing. Sometimes it's called the transmission of the lamp. I mean, they have their own issues with metaphors, I guess, you know. I mean, what is it that was transmitted? The light. So the light went from the mind of one to the mind of another. And so that's exactly what I'm talking about. Because how would you know what the enlightened mind looks like? How would you know what a Buddha mind looks like? I mean, everything you could think about it would just be within the limits of the thoughts you currently have, which are not that, because you've never experienced it, you've never gotten to it, which is ironic since it's your essence, but it's so subtly deep within you that you're out of touch with it. So you have no way of thinking about it that's accurate. So when you meet somebody that's there, then you see it. You know it. You recognize it. There it is. So what happens at that point? So it's kind of your mind, your awareness, encounters that presence of mind, that presence of awareness. And, oh, that's what it is. That's what it looks like. That's what the essence of me looks like. Because now I'm looking at it out there. Now I know what it is. I've seen it. Now I can go looking for it again. I know what to look for. It's kind of like if you were hunting elk, pardon me, this doesn't sound very Buddhist, but you're hunting elk. It's like, okay, I'm on an elk hunt, but I'm a Kalahari Bushman. I've never seen an elk, and I come to the United States, I'm on an elk hunt. And it's like, how would I know how to hunt an elk? I've never seen one. Oh, now I've seen an elk. Now I know what I'm hunting. Now I can go out in the woods and look for elk because I know what they are. So you see what I'm saying? So what happens with this mind-to-mind transmission is that it's like the mind of one being encounters the mind of another being. And it's sort of like, oh, that's what it is. Okay, now I can go off and I can look for that within myself. I know what it looks like. I can find it. I've seen little traces of it within myself. There's something called the ox herding drawings, which are in Japan anyway, famous, which is someone's off looking for an oxen that's gotten loose, and he sees the footprints, and then he'll see the tail of the oxen around a tree trunk or a bamboo forest. Eventually he'll see the whole oxen, and then he climbs on it and brings it back. And it's kind of like you're on this quest for yourself, and but you see that self in another person, then you know what to look for. Then you can go after it, and you can track it down within yourself. You can tune back into it by tuning into it in another person. You know what to look for, but it has this energy quality. It has this quality of presence. So it's not just abstract. So you meet that presence, and you say, ah. Okay, I've met that presence. This is what Buddha nature is like. So I can sort of, I know what it smells like, you know, so I, when I'm meditating, you know, like there's all this distraction going on and I'll smell a little of this perfume. It's like, ah, there it is. You know, I'll go that direction. Ah, it's getting a little bit stronger over there because, you know, I know what I'm looking for. I know what I can, not what I'm looking for. I mean, I know what it smells like. You know, so I can track it down that way, you know, and then it gets stronger and stronger. So that's the mind-to-mind transmission that you're asking about. I'm quite sure of that.
I also wonder, like, I've heard, like, in the Dalai Lama sounds, sometimes, like, people that, who knows what I won't mention, who have had, like, a high place in the Episcopal Church, met the Dalai Lama and said, I didn't feel, you know, I read all the Crystal Law about the Dalai Lama, but I didn't feel anything. And so we discussed that a lot afterwards, and I still wonder about that, too. It's like, so can he turn it on and off, or does it all have to do with the receiver?
Yeah, I think it's both, actually. Yeah, I think he turns it on and off, but it also has to do with the perceiver. I mean, I'll kind of give you a concrete example. When we were in Washington, so Kay and I were in Washington, D.C. at this 2 or 3 day conference that he was one of the main speakers at this conference. So he was up on the stage all the time. There was a lot of dialogue and presentations going on, panels. So he wasn't always presenting anything, but he was always sitting there. And so I had the experience of I'm sitting in the audience and I'm listening to what people are saying. And everything is totally just kind of like ordinary. Okay. And so my mind is thinking, why did I spend all this money and go to all this effort to come and sit here at a conference, which is not even all that interesting. And it's very, you know, it's like, all right. And so then some part of me thought, well, what are you doing this for? I mean, anyhow, they're going to audio record it. If you're really curious about what they have to say, why don't you sort of tune into what's going on here? And then, you know, there was this whole quality of his presence that sort of became apparent to me. So it was there all the time, but I wasn't attuning to it. On the other hand, I have seen him turn it on and off. It's kind of like, you know, kind of like put this thing out there, this energy out there, and people will experience it. And he can also sort of, you know, pull it back, constrain it a little bit. So, you know, I mean, there's some kind of combination of things going on, I think. That's my sense of it. There's no question about the, you know, if I walk into the situation with one kind of mind, something happens, and if I walk into the situation with a different kind of mind, something else happens. And it's always a challenge to figure out what's the thing to do.
I watched most of the DVD, I could tell, it was called The Case for Faith. And I got it from Netflix, and I wasn't quite sure, you know, how sort of, I knew it had like a Christian sort of orientation, but I wasn't quite sure. From the description, I thought it was more, less taking the position that Christianity was the way, the one and only way. But it was interesting, that they explored, I mean, one of the questions was, how can Christianity be the only way to salvation? Mm-hmm. And they specifically mentioned Buddhism, Islam, and other religions as saying that, well, they don't claim that this is the only way to go, whereas Christianity does, so therefore Christianity must be the only way to go. Which, you know, there's a little leap of logic.
That was a little hard one. That's hard.
And I'm sure I'm not doing justice to their argument, but and they took it from there. But anyway, I that's what was coming to mind when thinking about someone with a Christian perspective, you know, deeply held beliefs along those lines, saying, well, this is just another guy. I mean, sure, he's a religious scholar, he's a Buddhist scholar, but he's not Jesus. And Jesus is the only, is the way, the light, and the whatever, you know. The only track, so I'm just not getting it from this guy, you know. But on the other hand, I was thinking, David, when you were talking about sitting in the audience and going, this isn't what I wanted, you know. I was wondering if, like sitting in an audience like that, if you were to just focus your attention on the Dalai Lama who's sitting there up on a stage and maybe he's a couple hundred feet away or whatever, but to just sort of, you know, breathe him in and out and put your attention and sort of meditate on him in his presence, I bet that would be a way to sort of maybe draw that energy out.
It was exactly what I did.
Yeah.
That's precisely exactly what I did. I just thought, this is nuts. I'm crammed into this little seat in this row down here on the floor, which is supposed to be a good seat. I just got up, and I went up to the bleachers where it was more spacious, and I just sort of relaxed and just tuned in to him in exactly the way you're saying, and then all that presence, that energetic presence just opened up, and I was there with what I wanted to be with, which I hadn't been when I was busy thinking about what he was saying.
Yeah.
Crammed into a tight little seat with a bunch of other people who were thinking about what he was saying.
And there's a guy, Treat actually gave me this audio book, basically, guy Eckhart Tolle.
I've heard of him, yes.
And he described this process of, like, he talks about like a flower, you know, and you're looking at a flower, and you're breathing in and you're breathing out, and instead of thinking, I'm looking at a flower, you get beyond that, or you get inside that, and I'm not doing justice to the way you describe it, but basically, the way I've been able to practice it is, you know, I'm experiencing the flower, and I'm not thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And I do that out in nature all the time now, and it's great. It's fucking great. it's really calming, and it's really, it's great on a lot of levels for me. And that's sort of that meditative process. It's not like the deeper, more formal meditation mm-hmm. like we've done here, but it's very, it's very utilitarian. It's very useful. It's very accessible, and it's something that kind of gets you through the day. And so I think, yeah, I envy you that. I guess sitting there to be able to, you know, back to the idea of a teacher, that you can profit from that teacher. Both by what they're saying, I mean, like by the logical lesson that they're laying out for you, but also by experiencing their connection to closer to the core and kind of drink that in, breathe that in. Yeah,
but in a way, you're saying, I think, you know, what, so by saying this meditation with the flower,
yeah.
You know, that it's the same thing as, in a way that David was saying that he does with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
I mean, it's where you're starting. So you're putting all your consciousness and awareness towards the flower, and then it actually reveals itself to you and its energy. And I would think that because of that, that there'd be an incredible exchange, like the transition of mind, you could almost call it, between what you're doing that with. So if it's a flower, a tree, and one of the Zen Buddhist meditation prayers, it's like they say, Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. And Dharma gates can be anything. They can be a flower, they can be a cloud. And I think that's my interpretation.
So, and by the way,
they're talking about.
Dharma is the Buddhist word for Buddhism. So gates into Buddhism are boundless.
And teaching, too.
Both.
Yeah, so that, you know, a tree or a flower, you know, Dharma gate, if you put all your attention, your full presence towards that, and consciousness writing, or energy writing consciousness, right, awareness, putting that all onto that, and then having it, you know, come back to you, I would think that would be really, or I mean, from my experience too, but that's a really incredibly rich experience to do that. I've experienced that a lot with flowers in the garden too. That I felt like the garden is a Dharma gate for me, and individual flowers and so forth are a Dharma gate. When you give that a whole lot of attention in that direction, that, you know, comes back to you in that way. And it is. I think it's a good practice. It's a wonderful daily practice, and then, you know, the opportunity comes for that energy to be revealed in another way, then you practice, like, say, if you're a teacher showing up, you know, Dharma, or somebody like that showing up, then you prepared your mind mm-hmm. so that you know how to do it, you know how to read it. Mm-hmm.
And it's like I said earlier, I've only been doing this for maybe a year, but, you know, the more I do it, it seems like the better I get at it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The easier it is to sort of just do it. You know, to put your mind and your body and your presence in the right place that you can, you're able to successfully do it. And like you were saying, Dave, earlier, it's like when you feel it, you know it, or when you know it when it's happening, right?
Right.
And yeah, and the more it's like the more you practice, the easier it gets, and the more you get out of it, sort of. Mm-hmm. With less energy, you know, take less energy expended to get to the same place.
Are you familiar with the Tao Te Ching, Book of Tao?
I just heard of it, but I've never.
Oh, I thought you might have been. You would really enjoy reading it, I'm sure. It's a bunch of poems from, I don't know, 3,000 years ago, China, something like that, 2,600 years ago. Anyhow, there's one poem that came to mind when you were talking about this, which I can't replicate the poem. I don't have that kind of memory. But basically, it says that this source is like a well. This source, this thing you're talking about, is like a well, except that the more you draw out of it, the more there is to draw out of it.
Uh-huh.
It's a different kind of well in that respect.
Yeah.
It's like an endless spring, but it's not only an endless spring. The more you take, the more there is to take. It's not like, you know, some wells, you know, there are 50 gallons of water, and if you take 30 gallons out, there are 20 left. This is more like there are 50 gallons of water, you take 30 out, and there are 70 left.
Yeah. Well, it's like love.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't use love up. If you're loving, it creates more love.
It's a great metaphor.
Yeah.
So, what now? You want to try some meditating?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. And I'm going to use this one. And you can, whatever kind of chair cushion.